Good morning on this wonderful, bright, sunny, early spring morning. My name is Andy Pollack. I'm a member of this congregation, and we have in this church a policy of an open pulpit, which means that members of the congregation take services. So it's my turn today. So today is International Women's Day, very important day. So can we think about our sisters and wives and mothers and daughters? And can we also think about the innocent people, particularly of women and children in Iran and Lebanon, other parts of the Middle East and in Ukraine, who are caught in the horror of war? May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our powers to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to serve you, Spirit of Freedom. Okay, can we have the first hymn, hymn 61, Lo, the Earth Awakes Again. And the first reading is from Janet.
Morning, everybody. Today's reading is from a book called Growing Brave, and it's by a lady called Donna Ashworth. One of my favourite pieces of poetry is a poem called The Guest House by Hafiz, I think. It's been read in this church twice over the last 2 months or so. I like it because it invites us to embrace all of our temperament and our disposition and our predispositions, and it reminds us that everything is okay. Today's poem is titled Sadness Comes. So it's sort of a take on The Guest House, but in this poem we're taken into sadness and we're encouraged to embrace sadness and not to stay alone in our sadness. It's very short and it's light-hearted and it's very sweet. Sadness comes. Sadness came to tea last night, as she's often done before. But I did not let her in this time. I stopped her at the door. I'm off to meet with friends, I said. Your timing just isn't right. I cannot allow your atmosphere. It's just not the place tonight. But sadness would not take the hint. Her manners lack finesse. Her pace was slow and heavy, yet she kept up nonetheless. And even when I took my seat amongst my laughing friends, she squeezed herself right in between. Her boldness never ends. And I was sure my friends would loathe this spectre at the feast and somehow think me lesser for inviting such a beast. But no, their warmth was undeterred, as if nothing was askew. I think perhaps they know by now that I sometimes come as two. And even sadness seemed to glow a lighter shade of grey. To know that she's accepted seemed to lighten up her day. So let your sadness accompany you. Don't think her hard to share. There is no need to face her all alone. Just pull up an extra chair.
Okay, there seem to be quite a few children here. Would the children mind coming to the front? And I'll read a children's story. And then there's, after that, there's just another a little kind of treat. You're all very welcome. There's lots and lots of you. This is a story that I read my three-year-old granddaughter when she goes to bed, and it's called The Girl at the Front of the Class. And I'll ask you at the end what little girl is called. At school, my most favorite time of the day is story time. It's when we all stop wriggling and giggling and jiggling and listen as Mrs. Rivers, the teacher, reads one of our extra special books. But one afternoon, just as the story was about to begin, there was a knock, knock, knock on the classroom door. Mrs. Rivers opened the door, and standing there was a girl with eyes as wide and as golden as a tiger's, a face as pale as a glass of milk, and hair as shiny as a mirror. "Children," said Mrs. Rivers, "this is your new classmate. I want you all to welcome her and be her friend." Everyone smiled and waved at the new girl, but she only stared at the floor. Mrs. Rivers let the new girl sit at the front of the class, and I said hello. This is the boy telling the story. He's called Adam. I said hello, but she never said hello back. She didn't want to play with me in the playground or make a golden sandcastle in the sandpit. She didn't even seem to like story time. Mrs. Rivers said she could draw drawings instead. She drew things that I'd never seen before, like orange boats sailing in a storm and broken tents and houses that were on fire. And in every picture, there was a little girl all on her own crying. And that made me want to cry too. I wanted to know why the girl at the front of the class drew such sad drawings and why she never spoke. So I whispered my questions to the cleverest people I knew. "Because," said Mrs. Rivers, "even though she's just like you, she's had to leave her home and her parents and her school and all her friends too." "Because," said my dad, "even though she's just like you, she has had to say goodbye to all her toys and stories and travel to somewhere scary and new." "Because," said my grandma, "even though she's every bit as precious as you, she's all alone in the world and needs a friend who is patient and kind and true." These answers made me feel very sad. They made me wonder how to be her friend even more. At bedtime, I thought and thought and thought again until my heart gave my brain an idea. The next day, I gathered all the things I'd need. My crayons from under the sofa. I took Dad's newspaper. I chose 3 balls of wool from my grandma's special box and asked Mrs. Rivers for paints and paper and pots of pencils filled with every color. I painted and colored and cut and glued and created pictures so big and special that Mrs. Rivers let me sit outside. On the first day, the new girl didn't look at my drawings, not even once. But on the second day, she tiptoed closer. And on the third day, she tiptoed closer still, until she was so close she could see the new story I was making just for her. And there it is. The two of them, there's Adam and there's the new girl, in the castle, a rainbow, the sunshine, the trees, the animals. That's the picture he was making for her. My heart felt so happy, it did a skip and a jump and made me whisper, "Will you be my friend?" The new girl smiled a smile that was as beautiful as a butterfly. "Hello, friend," she said. "My name is Lila." "Hello, Lila. My name is Adam," I said. Now the girl at the front of the class says hello to me every day. We play in the playground at break time and build golden sandcastles in the golden sandpit. We love story time and draw drawings together, filled with birds of every color. There's the thing they draw together. Because school isn't as scary or lonely for somebody who has a best friend. Okay, that's the story. Now, we've got a special treat here because I'm going to ask Fatima to come up. Fatima. Fatima is from Afghanistan. And Fatima has kind of done what this little girl has done. She's come from the far side of the world where bad things were happening to live in Ireland.
Hello to everyone. I'm Fatima. I'm from Afghanistan. I was born as a refugee in Iran and I raised as a refugee there. In that time that I was a child, I didn't understand that what is nationality, and I just played with other children, and some of them just used Afghani as an insult to us. Even sometimes they want to insult each other, and they used Afghani. And on that time, I thought that, oh, maybe Afghani is just an insult. So maybe sometimes even I used it by myself to other children that they want to insult them. After the time that I tried to going to school, and I understand that we can't go to regular schools, public schools that other children are going, because we were Afghan, and we just allowed to go some little schools that were built for Afghan people. And on that time, I understand that what is Afghan. And even when I was in university last year, some of my classmates, they were adult, they weren't child anymore, but when they went insult each other, they called each other Afghani, and I was just feel that here it's not my home, and they accept me as an Iranian, even if I was born there, and most of my culture is belong to Iran because I was born there and I was educated there. And then when we came back to Afghanistan, I felt that, oh my God, I finally can find my home in Afghanistan. And when we went to Afghanistan, we just found that, no, it's not like my home, because I'm from Hazara community, and Hazara community is always being a target for genocide and discrimination in Afghanistan as well. And even other groups just want to insult us as a Hazara, because our group is different in even in appearance, so they can recognize that we are Hazara and we are different. And so I didn't feel home even in my country. So I found that, then I came to Ireland, and I found a lot of differences between Ireland and Afghanistan, or even Iran, because in Afghanistan, for the first days, I went to a beach, I think, with Mary, and I saw a lot of women and men that were swimming together, and even they don't care each other that who cares to our body or what they wear or something like this. But in Afghanistan, women can't go to street without a man, or they can't go to university, even they can't go to school after 10 years old, and they can't speak loudly even. They can't choose what they wear. They can't see properly through the burqa, and all the people are just silent for this situation in Afghanistan and for Afghan women. I think that there is a lot of difference between here and Afghanistan, and I just found that everything that you born here with all the rights that I fight for them, like education, like freedom to wear, like freedom to speak and have a job. Even in Afghanistan, some women, they don't have any men in their family, but how they can earn money, how they can pay for their family. So it's very hard situation, and the most feeling that I feel these days, it's a survivor's guilty. I feel guilty about my family, about my country, that I'm safe, I have everything that I want, and I achieve them with coming to Ireland, but still there is a bad situation in Afghanistan, and still my family are in Tehran and they are in war, and my other friends in Afghanistan are in war, are in a bad situation as well. And I hope that I can find my home here in Ireland. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Fatima. Fatima will be down having coffee afterwards if anybody wants to ask her any questions. So for my reading, I did something I'd never done before. I used AI. I'm not a very technical person, but I thought I'd give it a go. And I put into ChatGPT, International Women's Day essay, Why Women Are So Wonderful. And this is what came out. Every year on International Women's Day, people around the world take time to recognize the achievements, strength, and contributions of women in every part of society. It is a day not only to celebrate progress, but also to appreciate the qualities that make women remarkable, qualities that have shaped families, communities, cultures, and history itself. One of the most wonderful things about women is their resilience. Throughout history, women have faced significant barriers in education, and we've been hearing from Fatima, they still face huge barriers in education in Afghanistan, employment and political participation. Despite these challenges, women have continually demonstrated courage and determination. From fighting for equal rights to leading social change, women have shown that persistence and strength can overcome even the most difficult obstacles. Another remarkable quality often associated with women is empathy. Women frequently play central roles in nurturing relationships and building supportive communities. Whether as mothers, friends, teachers, leaders, or caregivers, many women bring compassion and emotional understanding into the spaces they occupy. This ability to connect with others and offer support helps strengthen families and societies. Women are also extraordinary innovators and leaders. Across science, arts, politics, and business, women have made groundbreaking contributions that changed the world. Figures like Marie Curie in science, Rosa Parks in civil rights, and Malala Yousafzai in education advocacy demonstrate the diverse ways women have shaped history. Their work reminds us that talent and vision are not limited by gender. Creativity is another reason women are so wonderful. Women have enriched literature, music, art, and culture for centuries. Through storytelling, design, performance, and expression, they help societies imagine new possibilities and understand human experiences more deeply. Women's voices add perspective and diversity that make culture richer and more inclusive. Perhaps most importantly, women contribute profoundly to everyday life in ways that are sometimes overlooked. They balance multiple responsibilities, support others' dreams, and often serve as the backbone of households and communities. Their strength is not only found in historic achievements, but also in the quiet daily acts of care, resilience, and determination that keep the world moving forward. International Women's Day reminds us that celebrating women is not just about acknowledging the past, it is about supporting equality and opportunity for the future. By valuing women's contributions and ensuring their voices are heard, societies become stronger, fairer, and more compassionate. In every culture and generation, women continue to inspire, lead, and uplift those around them. That enduring impact is exactly why women are so wonderful and why they deserve to be celebrated not only on International Women's Day, but every day of the year. And now we have a prayer and reflection time. I'm not going to use a prayer. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give a reflection from this wonderful writer, Karen Armstrong, who I'm also going to quote when I give my address. This is from Karen Armstrong. It's about the golden rule. The golden rule, treat others as you would wish to be treated yourself, is not a notional doctrine that you either agree with or make yourself believe. It is a method, and the only adequate test of any method is to put it into practice. Throughout the centuries, people have found that when they behaved in accordance with the golden rule, they experienced a deeper, fuller level of existence, and they have maintained that anybody can achieve this state if they put their mind to it. But it will be a slow, incremental, and imperceptible process. First, make a resolution to act once every day in accordance with the positive version of the golden rule. Treat others as you would wish to be treated yourself. This need not be a grand, dramatic gesture. It can be a little, nameless, unremembered act that may seem quite insignificant to you. Perhaps you make a point of giving an elderly relative a call, help your wife with the chores, or take time to listen to a colleague who is anxious or depressed. Look for an opportunity to create a spot of time in somebody's life, and this awareness will increase as you become more proficient in mindfulness. Second, resolve each day to fulfill the negative version of the golden rule. Do not do unto others what you would not like them to do to you. Try to catch yourself before you make that brilliantly wounding remark, asking yourself how you would like to be on the receiving end of such sarcasm, and refrain. Each time you succeed will be what the Greeks call an ecstasis, a transcendence of ego. Third, make an effort once a day to change your thought patterns. If you find yourself indulging in a bout of anger or self-pity, try to channel all that negative energy into a more kindly direction. If you are in a rut of resentment, make an effort to think of something for which you know you should be grateful, even if you do not feel it at the time. As you brush your teeth or put the cat out at the end of the day, check to see if you have performed your three actions. Sometimes you will find that you have not done so. Sometimes you will remember that, on the contrary, you have behaved unkindly and inconsiderately. At this point, recall what you learned during the third step and have compassion on yourself. Smile wryly at your admission and resolve to do better tomorrow. And can we now say the prayer that Jesus taught us? Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Okay, so the next hymn is hymn 88, Calm Soul of All Things. This address is called A Woman's Case for God. It's not women's case for God. It's a case made by one particularly brilliant theologian called Karen Armstrong. And it's taken from this book, The Case for God by Karen Armstrong, who's a very celebrated theologian and former Catholic nun. Now, this isn't an easy book, and much of its history of people's belief in and theologians teaching about God was above my level of understanding. However, her conclusions are crystal clear. Armstrong does not believe that just thinking about religion will provide us with information about the concept we call God, or about the origins of our world as part of the universe. Quote, "Religion's task," she writes, "closely allied to that of art, has always been to help us live creatively, peacefully, and even joyously with realities for which there are no easy explanations, and problems that we cannot solve: mortality, pain, grief, despair, and outrage at the injustice and cruelty of life. Over the centuries, people in all cultures discovered that by pushing their reasoning powers to the limit, stretching language to the end of its tether, and this is the most important thing, living as selflessly and compassionately as possible, they experienced a transcendence that enabled them to affirm their suffering with serenity and courage. She stressed that religion is a practical discipline that requires a great deal of effort. Its insights are not derived from abstract speculation, but from spiritual exercises and a dedicated lifestyle. She said there was much to be learned from older ways of thinking about religion. Quote, "Far from regarding revelation as static, fixed, and unchanging, Jews, Christians, and Muslims all knew that revealed truth was symbolic, that scripture could not be interpreted literally, and that sacred texts had multiple meaning and could lead to entirely fresh insights. Revelation was not an event that happened to one in the distant past, but was an ongoing creative process that required human ingenuity," which was something the former long-serving minister of this church, Saville Hicks, used to teach. She went on, "They understood that revelation did not provide us with infallible information about the divine, because this would always remain beyond our ken. Religious teaching was essentially a program for action. Quote, you had to engage with a symbol imaginatively, become ritually and ethically involved with it, and allow it to affect a profound change in you. Many people today can work with the symbolism of the modern God in this way. Backed up by ritual and compassionate self-emptying practice, it still introduces them to the transcendence that gives meaning to their lives. In the past, religious people were open to all manner of different truths. Jewish, Christian, and Muslim scholars were ready to learn from the pagan Greeks who had sacrificed to idols, as well as from each other. The Jesuits encouraged the young Descartes to read Galileo and were fascinated by early modern science. In England, the Puritan and Protestant ethos was felt to be congenial to early modern science and helped its advance and acceptance. Armstrong suggests that today, when science is becoming less defined and discernible, it is perhaps time to return to a theology that, quote, asserts less and is more open to silence and unknowing, and also to dialogue with more thoughtful forms of atheism. In ancient Greece, writers and philosophers like Euripides and Protagoras were accused of atheism when they denied the Olympian gods in favor of a more transcendent theology. The first Christians and Muslims who were moving away from traditional paganism were persecuted as atheists by their contemporaries. Quote, when we have eaten a strong tasting dish in a restaurant, we often offered a sorbet to cleanse our palate so that we can taste the next course properly. An intelligent atheist critique could help us to rinse our minds of the more facile theology that is impeding our understanding of the divine. We may find that for a while we have to go into what mystics call the dark night of the soul, or the cloud of unknowing. This will not be easy for people used to getting information at the click of a mouse, but the novelty and strangeness of this negative capability could surprise into awareness that exact, methodical, logical reasoning is not the only means of acquiring knowledge. It is not only a poet like Keats who must, while waiting for new inspiration, be capable of, quote, being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Armstrong quotes the 4th century theologian and bishop Basil that we can never know God through word, but can only glimpse his or her or its traces or effects in our time-bound, sense-bound world. She says, it is clear that meditation, yoga, and rituals that work aesthetically have, when practiced assiduously over a lifetime, a marked effect on the personality. There is no dramatic born-again conversion, but a slow, incremental, and imperceptible transformation. Above all, the habitual practice of compassion and the golden rule, as we've seen, treat others as you would wish to be treated yourself, which is common to all the world's great religions, continuously demands what the ancient Greeks called kenosis, the emptying of the self, the dismantling of egotism. The ancient philosophers deliberately humanized the sacred. Holiness was not supernatural, but a carefully crafted attitude that, as one Confucian philosopher explained, refined humanity and elevated it to a godlike plane. When Buddhists contemplated the tranquility, poise, and selflessness of the Buddha, they saw him as the avatar of the otherwise incomprehensible Nirvana. This was what Nirvana looked like in human terms. Christians had a similar experience when their imitation of Christ brought them glimpses of deification. Certain individuals became icons of this enhanced, refined humanity. Socrates, approaching his execution without recrimination, but with open-hearted kindness, cheerfulness, and serenity. Jesus, undergoing an agonizing death and experiencing the extremity of despair, while forgiving his executioners, making provision for his mother, and having a kindly word for one of his fellow victims. Muslims venerate the Prophet Muhammad as the perfect man, whose life symbolizes total receptivity to the divine that characterizes the ideal human being. Just as the feats of a dancer or an athlete are impossible for an untrained body and seem superhuman to most of us, these people all developed a spiritual capacity that took them beyond the norm and revealed to their followers the untapped divine or enlightened potential that exists in any man or woman. Armstrong says, the point of religion was to live intensely and richly here and now. Religious people are ambitious. They want lives overflowing with significance. They've always desired to integrate with their daily lives the moments of rapture and insight that come to them in dreams, in their contemplation of nature, and in their intercourse with one another and with the animal world. Instead of being crushed and embittered by the sorrow of life, they sought to retain their peace and serenity in the midst of their pain. They yearned for the courage to overcome their terror of mortality. Instead of being grasping and mean-spirited, they aspired to live generously, large-heartedly, and justly, and to inhabit every single part of their humanity. Quote, they tried to honor the inexpressible mystery they sensed in each human being and create societies that honored the stranger, the alien, the poor, and the oppressed. Of course, they often failed. But overall, they found that the disciplines of religion helped them to do all this. Those who applied themselves most assiduously showed that it was possible for mortal men and women to live on a higher divine or godlike plane and thus wake up to their true selves. Armstrong finishes her book with a story about the Buddha. One day a Brahmin, i.e. a Hindu priest, came across the Buddha sitting in contemplation under a tree and was astonished by his serenity, stillness, and self-discipline. The impression of immense strength channeled creatively into an extraordinary peace reminded him of a great elephant. Are you a god, sir? The priest asked. Are you an angel? Are you a spirit? No, the Buddha replied. He explained that he had simply revealed a new potential in human nature. It was possible to live in this world of conflict and pain at peace and in harmony with one's fellow creatures. There was no point in merely believing it. You would only discover its truth if you practiced his method, systematically cutting off egotism at the root. You would then live at the peak of your capacity, active parts of the psyche that normally lie dormant, and become fully enlightened human beings. Remember me, the Buddha told the curious priest, as one who is awake. Amen. And now can we sing the next hymn, which is hymn 108, My Life Flows On in Endless Song. Here are the notices. First, thank you to all the people who helped me with the service. To Josh for the wonderful music. To Maud for the books that she lent me to prepare the service. To Ayla for getting the church ready. For Janet for reading and flowers and coffee and all sorts of other things. Thank you, Janet, in particular. And Lorraine and Catherine for coffee. Bridget is looking for butter boxes to put plants in for the next plant sale. So please talk to Bridget about that. Please join us downstairs for tea and coffee, and particularly visitors, please come on down and have coffee with us and chat to us. Pam leads our weekly service of reflection in the church every Wednesday from 1:05 to 1:35. These sessions can also be accessed live on our webcam. The next Heart and Soul contemplative gathering will be on Monday, the 23rd of March at 7:30 here in the church. Please reserve your place with Shari. Details will be in the e-newsletter. And if you wish to receive that newsletter, please give your email address to Josh. The Unitarian Walkers will return to Skerries on the 28th of March, where Frank Tracy will lead the group, telling some interesting stories about Holme Patrick Church and those buried in the graveyard. Meeting up at 10:30 for coffee in Skerries Mill. More details from Marcus. The next Sunday's At Two concert will be on the 29th of March, featuring music for guitar, violin and cello. As always, please get your free ticket on eventbrite.ie. Just search for Unitarian and you'll find the concert. Voluntary donations on the day are welcome. Gavin's ordination and installation service as our next minister will be on Saturday the 21st of March at 2 p.m. here in the church. All are welcome and encouraged to be present for this important milestone in the life of the congregation. Finally, there will be a managing committee meeting tomorrow evening at 7:30 on Zoom. And finally, my favorite hymn, and I know it's a hymn that many people in this congregation love, hymn 159, This Is My Song.
Sorrow will one day turn to joy. All that breaks the heart and oppresses the soul will one day give place to peace and understanding, and everyone will be free.